The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
Hey everyone, and welcome to our throwback episode. In our throwback episodes, we are reintroducing you to some of our most popular episodes. This is great for new listeners who want to learn more about the work we've done in the past, and it's a great refresher if you've been a listener for a long time. Enjoy. So what kind of negotiations are you dealing with? Who are you negotiating with typically?
So in any given case, especially cases with children, there's usually an element of negotiation with the opposing counsel or opposing party, as well as with my own client, and to an extent with the court as well, once you get to the trial stages and in various aspects of the hearings. But people often think about with attorneys that the negotiation is always with the opposing side. And I oftentimes in my practice, it can be with my own client that I'm doing a lot of the negotiation, whether that's coming up with a settlement offer that we're going to send to the other side, or with really just bringing my client down to an attainable goal. That can often be a challenge, particularly once we get into later stages of a case. If we're heading into a trial and my client has a position that may or may not be attainable, it can be really difficult to reason with them without sacrificing their goals to try to make them see the pros and cons of what offer may or may not be on the table, the benefits of accepting an offer and knowing the outcome as opposed to taking that risk and leaving the decision up to the court if you go into a trial setting. And those can be particularly challenging when people feel like they're not getting all it is that they want. And sometimes clients have very realistic, attainable goals, and there's very minimal negotiation between myself and the client. And other times, the emotions can be so high that they just don't necessarily realize or understand the legal process enough to know what it is they can or cannot get if we proceed all the way with a contested trial.
Right. And I want to key in on this because this is something that a lot of business owners can relate to. Because as the business owner, most likely, at least I hope so, you're the expert in the situation when it comes to you and your client or your customer. But a lot of times the customer or client would ask for something that's unrealistic, and you're put in a position where you need to let them know, hey, that's not going to work, but this will, and have them trust you. But for you, there's another barrier, because it's not just logical, it's emotional. So
Sure. How
do you use emotions in those situations with your clients?
In these parenting situations, especially, since those are the most emotionally driven aspects of my field, it's important to remind clients, what all a trial and contested case process can entail. A lot of times parents want their children with them 100% of the time or the vast majority of the time, when if there's really nothing wrong with the other parent as a parent, other than the fact that the two parents just don't get along, a court may not be taking away a 50-50 time or whatever schedule it is that they're looking for. It may suit their needs, but isn't necessarily going to be perceived as being in the best interest of the child. And going through that process and explaining, whether there's a guardian ad litem and if there's a recommendation on the table that the court may heavily consider, really talking about the impact of that recommendation in a case, as well as talking about just the emotions of trial in and of itself. By the time we get to a trial in a custody case or a divorce case involving children, there's a good chance that we're already a year down the road from the time the start of the initial case was filed, sometimes longer. At this point, these people have both invested time and money to get here, and oftentimes people get so hung up with, this is what I've been fighting for all this time, I don't want to give in and sacrifice my goals after I'm so invested in this. And it's important for people to take into account what a trial can really do to these people. for instance, these two parents, when this custody case is closed, on the attorney side of things, you know, the case is closed. It's off my schedule, but these two people need to continue with this parenting time schedule at the very least until their children are 18. And realistically, they're going to be parents for the rest of their lives. Children grow up, children have other children, have graduations, have weddings, and these people are going to have to interact with each other a lot longer than just the trial itself. And going through a trial and experiencing the mudslinging that parents often kind of have to go through to show why they're the better parent can be really damaging to that relationship after the case is done. Because if you've just pulled all the emotions out and done everything to rip each other down, which unfortunately some of these cases can get to, you know, it can be very difficult for them emotionally to pick up the pieces after the fact. So I always like to remind parents that, especially if they're on at least decent communication terms, that there's some value in salvaging their ability to communicate and work together as parents, even if it means maybe making a couple sacrifices from what they really would want if it's entirely up to them.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. And so what I'm hearing here is first educating them on the process, which is really important because it helps you to establish expectations. And really the foundation for any relationship is, or the thing that really hurts relationships, and in this case, the relationship between you and your client, would be the violation of expectations. So you're right, educating them up front and setting those expectations is going to be important. And then also helping them to keep things in perspective, because a lot of times when people are highly emotional, they think in a short-term type of manner, but it sounds like you do a good job of helping them to understand their long-term goals and not just focus on winning short-term battles, but focusing on the war overall.
Absolutely, Eamon. And in general, the expectations can be tough on people when emotions are involved. Just with the amount of time things take, you know, especially in family law, and I'm sure in other aspects of business and law as well, things don't necessarily happen overnight the way that somebody wants them to. On a personal and emotional level, I completely understand what the frustration is that these people feel. One of the most frustrating things is getting them to understand really how to get what it is that they're trying to get, if that's even a possible goal. I mean, somebody can't walk in and expect it to be an emergency in the eyes of the law because somebody has, you know, a bad attendance record when the kids are with them. Or maybe they're not eating the best foods and eating a lot of fast food or frozen foods at mom and dad, and one parent has a problem with that. Things like that, that aren't emergencies in the eyes of law, can be very difficult. Because if it takes a few months to get a hearing, from there we have to actually prove that these are concerns that are genuine and are negatively affecting the children's interest. Mm-hmm. You know, it's tough for people to accept that there isn't necessarily that instant gratification that they're looking for. It's easy for someone to say, how can the court set another hearing and wait for an investigation to be done when I think that the other parent is using drugs around my children? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, if we can't prove that, if we need to get a drug test and get something done to investigate and determine whether this is actually going on and whether it's going on around the children, those things just take time. And it's tough for these people to sit there day to day knowing that these concerns are on their mind without necessarily seeing the results right away that they're looking for.
Right. And so how do you manage those emotions with peers? So when you're with a colleague, because in law, a lot of times people have the idea, well, you're my attack dog, they're their attack dog, so go at it. But in law, we have to manage the relationships with opposing counsel because most likely we're going to see them again and again. So when they are experiencing emotions, or probably yourself too, how do you handle those negotiations with all the other attorneys?
Sure. I mean, in any case, you know, it's my job to pursue the client's goals and to try to focus on the legal side of things and be objective while fighting for their subjective goals. But it can be difficult. There are cases that they get to me emotionally, especially in situations where there's more severe things going on, whether that be violence or neglect or various other concerns. It can be really tough, even on a personal note, when your client doesn't get what it is they want when they want. And I do my best to...
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. In the last 100 years, we've seen financial markets swing, new currencies come and go, decades of savings lost in days, all showing that a retirement plan without a guarantee, quite simply, isn't enough. So more than a retirement plan, TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life, a promise that pays off. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
Hi, I'm Tomer Korn, LinkedIn's Chief Product Officer. On my podcast, Building One, we dive deep into what it takes to build great products. Recently, we had Zach Perret, the CEO of Plaid, and he shared about his struggles building a financial app for consumers and how he was able to turn it all around with a critical pivot. Take a listen.
I personally couldn't resonate as much with the consumer set that we were trying to reach. I just didn't have that level of empathy. When we made the shift to building a B2B product, though, I was building the product that I wanted. My co-founder and I were creating the product that we wanted ourselves, and we had so much empathy for what that product was.
Such a great insight.
You know, in that sense, we got lucky because we were creating a thing for ourselves. And then the people that we were talking to also had the same problems we did. They were fintech developers. We'd been a fintech developer. We'd been trying to build a fintech product for a year. And so... we had such deep empathy. We had such a clear ability to...
If you want to hear more of Zach Perret's story and the lessons that follow, listen and subscribe to my podcast, Building One.
I don't want to say hide those emotions. I think it's important for a client to realize that you're not a robot, that, you know, we do feel what they're feeling, but staying focused on how it is that we're going to get to the end result. And that applies as well in communications with opposing counsel. It may mean reminding them of your client's emotions and letting them know that, look, you know, I understand your position here, but I'm not going to get into that offer because we're just not at that stage emotionally. There are cases where I'll talk with an opposing counsel and say, you know, I'll do my best to talk to my client and get them there. If it's a reasonable offer that's on the table. Other times that, whether the offer is reasonable or not, that may just not be an emotional option for where my client's at a particular point in the case. And I think relaying that to opposing counsel is important, one, on a professional note, so that they understand where you are at in your relationship with your client, but also so that you don't waste time working towards something that just isn't... it isn't the right time to be at that place. It's also important to understand the same on the flip side, that opposing counsel is also representing somebody who also has emotions involved. And it can be very frustrating when you feel like there's a reasonable solution that would be best for everybody involved, but the other side just isn't there. So that's something that always needs to be communicated with an opposing counsel as far as where you're at, if you want to be able to continue to have a working relationship and work towards settlement, which is generally the end goal in any case, if that's something that's possible. With an opposing party, it can be a little bit difficult if there's not an attorney on the other side, because I think attorneys, generally speaking, are pretty good at being able to set aside the personal emotions of it and talk the logistics and talk the procedure, whereas an opposing party may not understand the process and may be so hung up on the emotions that there are times that you come to an impasse where you can't negotiate further. And accepting where you're at may be the solution for negotiation at a certain point in time, and accepting that negotiation isn't always an option in certain settings.
Right. I want to key in on one of the things that you said. You said that sometimes the opposing party would make an offer that you feel is reasonable, but you know your client isn't emotionally there yet. And so a lot of times in negotiation, we focus too much on the tangible items. So what are the damages? How much do you owe me? Those type of things. But mm-hmm. we forget about the intangible items like emotion, because those are things that really need to be addressed. So how do you manage to quantify emotions in these types of negotiations?
When it comes to child-related issues, I guess those I would consider in a separate category, since there's not necessarily something quantifiable. But in terms right. of property and finances, in these cases, emotions do come into play. In theory, property and finances are more black and white issues, in that if there is one value of something, it's something that should be equitably divided in a court case. I mean, certainly there's valuation and other negotiation aspects that play into that, but there are even emotional impacts on the property issues. For instance, who gets to keep a house? People may have sentimental attachments to a house. People may have, it may be a pride issue for some people, where maybe they are okay with paying spousal support or paying child support, but the idea of giving money to the other person is just something that they don't want to do it out of spite. And that's something to consider as well. I have cases where people would rather pay a higher amount of child support than really they would necessarily be required to if we went to trial, but have no spousal support because they like the mental idea that all their money is going to the support of their children and not to the support of their ex-spouse. It's that idea of, I don't want to give him or her a dime of my money. That maybe isn't necessarily reasonable, but it's a very real aspect of these cases in some situations.
Right. And I want to tease that out a little bit, because I know I caught that because I know I'm a lawyer, but differentiating between spousal support and child support, because that was a really great point you made. Can you tease that out a little bit more?
Sure. I mean, there are different factors on the legal side that I won't get into the nitty gritty of it, but that come into play there, where emotionally there's no factor the court's going to consider that says, what does the parent want with respect to child versus spousal support? But oftentimes people are more comfortable with giving money that they feel is going directly towards their children, as opposed to the idea of, well, I'm going to let my spouse continue to maintain this lifestyle. And the reality is, especially in longer-term divorces, where the parties were married for many years, especially in cases where there's a parent who maybe became a stay-at-home parent or whose career went to the wayside for the sake of the children, while the other one continued to grow professionally. The reality is, spousal support is designed to help those parties transition and to be able to get on their feet and get to a place financially to support themselves a little better. If somebody's been out of the workforce for 10, 15 years, that's not going to happen overnight. But when people, it's important to explain what these support figures are for, to explain that to someone and, tell a client, hey, well, you've been working for 20 years while your spouse has done nothing to build a resume, is older and maybe would have a difficult time getting back into the workforce in general, and explaining to them what that's there for, when oftentimes they still get so hung up on the idea of, well, if he or she thinks that he or she can continue to live the lifestyle we had while we're married, that they've got something coming to them. It's that idea of, I don't want to continue to support someone while they sit at home and don't work. They may have been fine with that while they were married and that was a family decision together, but nobody likes the idea of, well, I'm going to continue to work and pay my money to somebody who isn't working. But it's important to bring them back to what that's there for, why the law is what it is, so that they realize they're not just paying money so that somebody can continue to spend or to live this high standard of living that they are not earning themselves. It's to focus, to refocus them on the fact that these parties are transitioning.
I really love that point. And so I want to take a second and highlight that because it really shows the importance of framing. You can give the same offer, but frame it a little bit differently, and then somebody would accept it versus if you framed it the previous way, they wouldn't have accepted it. So for the listeners out there, the difference between spousal support and child support is that the money that goes to child support is focused on the children, and the money that goes to the spouse is focused on the spouse. But it's all money that essentially, for the most part, kind of goes to the same place. And so if you were to frame the argument saying, hey, you know, we need this much money, but it's for the kids, people are going to be more willing to accept it because you framed it in a way that it seems like the kids are winning and not the spouse on the other end of the table. So I'm really glad you brought that point up. Another thing I wanted you to talk about was apologies and whether or not that has a place in negotiation. Have you ever experienced an instance in your settlement negotiations where a genuine apology made a difference in the outcome?
Oh, absolutely. Especially when in the context of parenting issues in my cases. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes when parents have a really damaged relationship between the two of them, maybe there was some adultery, maybe there was some domestic violence between the two of them. Oftentimes parents feel like they cannot communicate with each other because of this damaged relationship that they experienced through the years when, despite their poor relationship, they may both have great relationships with their children and may both be very involved in the upbringing of their children. And there are cases where if these parties just sit down and talk in a room and clear the air a little bit and actually hear what the other one has experienced, it can make an impact on their willingness to continue to work together and work towards settlement in a case.
Congratulations! You've just joined an elite club. By listening to a full episode, you're now officially on the Negotiate Anything team. So welcome aboard! What most team members do is they subscribe to the podcast because that allows them to automatically get the latest episodes of the show. The best things in life lie on the other side of difficult conversations. Keep learning, keep practicing, and keep getting better. Your relationships will improve, your career will soar, and you'll have the confidence you need to get the most out of these crucial conversations. Again, thank you for joining the team. We're excited to have you, and I will see you in the next episode. I'll catch you later.